Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. It has been a deadly 24 hours in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's defense minister says fighting in a strategic eastern Ukrainian town has killed 15 soldiers and 7 civilians. Minister Stepan Polterak said today 30 soldiers were wounded in the tank and artillery fire between the soldiers and Russian-backed separatists in the government-held town of Debaltseve, a rail junction that connects two rebel centers. The African Union is moving forward with a proposal to send 7,500 troops to fight Boko Haram in West Africa. AU leaders meeting in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa for a two-day summit ending today. AU Commissioner for Peace and Security, Smail Tchegui.
We will have indeed the challenge of financing this force, and discussions are ongoing, and for us, indeed, the best will be within the assessed contributions of UN.
The AU will now seek the approval of the United Nations and funding to build the force. Boko Haram's five-year Islamic uprising has killed about 10,000 people in the past year and displaced 1 million. U.S. prosecutors have charged a third American citizen in connection with last month's attempted coup in Gambia. The Justice Department said Friday a 41-year-old U.S. resident with Gambian citizenship is charged with conspiring to invade a friendly country. On Thursday, another U.S. citizen pleaded guilty to charges related to the attempt to overthrow President Yahya Jammeh's government. Thousands of Shiite Muslims took to the streets across Pakistan today in protest of a powerful bomb blast at a mosque in Sindh province during Friday prayers that killed at least 58 people, wounded more than 50 others, some quite seriously. The Sunni Muslim group Jundallah, a splinter group of the Pakistani Taliban, is claiming responsibility for the attack, just the latest in a string of sectarian violence in Pakistan. This is VOA News. The U.S. military said Friday a coalition airstrike killed an Islamic State chemical weapons expert last week near the Iraqi city of Mosul. That news came just hours after Iraq's Kurdish forces withstood and repelled a major attack by Islamic State fighters in Kirkuk province. Edward Iranian reports.
Kurdish Peshmerga fighters exchanged volleys of automatic rifle fire with Islamic State militants Friday south of the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. The surprise Islamic State attack bore witness to the group's resilience despite a series of setbacks in both Iraq and Syria. Islamic State militants also detonated a car bomb inside Kirkuk in a failed attempt to break into a prison by breaching the walls of the city's police headquarters. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Negotiations with Islamic State militants in an attempt to save the lives of a Japanese journalist and a Jordanian military pilot appear to be at a standstill today. The militants threatened to kill the pair if Jordan did not release an Iraqi woman from death row for her role in a deadly 2005 bombing attack in Amman. People in Jordan and Japan took to the streets Friday calling for the hostages' safe return. Relations between Russia and the West are about to become even more strained after an inquiry in London into the poisoned death of a former Russian spy. Investigators are accusing Russian President Vladimir Putin of directing a mafia state, while this week the Royal Air Force intercepted Russian bombers close to British airspace. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Two Russian Tupolev Tu-95 aircraft, known as Bear Bombers, were intercepted close to British airspace Wednesday. Normally, the Russian aircraft skirt the far north of Britain. This time, the flight path was different, says Elizabeth Quintana of the Royal United Services Institute.
They were right down on the south coast in the channel between the UK and France, and also they were flying without their transponders on.
Quintana believes Moscow could have directed its bombers towards Britain in response to a public inquiry in London into the murder of Alexander Litvinenko, the former Russian spy. He died in 2006 after ingesting radioactive polonium. On his deathbed, he accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of ordering his assassination. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
A top Russian official is accusing a leading financial rating agency of trying to turn tycoons against the Kremlin. Standard & Poor's earlier this week downgraded Russia's credit rating to a non-investment grade for the first time in more than a decade. In Parliament's remarks on Friday, Deputy Prime Minister Igor Shulov said that the goal of the downgrade was to push businesses to withdraw their support for the government and for President Vladimir Putin. The downgrade of Russia's sovereign debt is triggering a downgrade in Russian businesses' grades as well. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Like Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram and ISIS, all these terrorists, they have committed unspeakable brutality against humanity.
The African Union Heads of State Summit ends in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
The only language they know, you understand, is destruction. And destruction does not single out any political party per se. So in that sense, I say it does not affect only APC.
Some Nigerians expressed concern about possible violence between supporters of rival political parties in the Niger Delta region ahead of the February 14 general election.
The place I live in, we have a security personnel downstairs. So knowing my neighbor is totally none of my business. Yeah, and doesn't make me feel any secure.
And Kenya launches community policing effort to protect civilians following recent attacks carried out by Al-Shabaab militants. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The African Union is moving forward with a request for a military force to stop the spread of the Boko Haram insurgency in West Africa. VOA East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslow reports as the AU summit in Addis Ababa comes to an end, leaders have postponed consideration of a potentially damning report on those responsible for the ongoing conflict in South Sudan.
African Union Commissioner for Peace and Security, Samael Cherghi, said Saturday the first meetings on the formation of a 7,500-troop force to confront Boko Haram will take place in Cameroon in the coming days, followed by consultations at the United Nations to seek endorsement and funding for the mission.
We will have indeed the challenge of financing this force, and discussions are ongoing, and for us, indeed, the best will be within the assessed contributions of UN.
The AU Peace and Security Council has requested a multinational African force to conduct operations against the Islamist group, which is based in Nigeria, but is seen as an increasing threat to the country's neighbors, in particular Cameroon and Chad. Regional military efforts to confront the group gained momentum last week as Chadian forces retook control of a northern Nigerian town seized by Boko Haram. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon welcomed the decision to form a regional front against the Islamist group and said combating the threat of terror everywhere requires cooperation among nations.
Like Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram and ISIS, all these terrorists, they have committed unspeakable brutality against humanity. Not a single country, even the regional countries, cannot handle this alone.
Another pressing security challenge, the ongoing conflict in South Sudan, has been put aside. The AU Peace and Security Council decided late Friday to postpone consideration of an AU inquiry report on South Sudan that allegedly names and shames those responsible for committing war crimes in the country. Human rights groups have called for the AU to make the report public. Taking the lead instead, the East African Group of Nations, IGAD, has organized power-sharing talks between South Sudan's warring factions at a hotel in Addis Ababa. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Meanwhile, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe was chosen to head the continental body. For the latest update, reporter Sandra Nyaira of VOA Zimbabwe Service joins us live via telephone link up from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Hello, Sandra.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And how are you doing?
I'm good, enjoying the sun in Africa. Just that, you know, so many issues that are being discussed at the African Union Summit that really, you know, when you look at, you know, that Africa needs to be, you know, to continue working hard to deal with these issues. So those are the issues that, you know, the leaders are still grappling with. They go towards the end of the summit.
Now, Sandra, there seems to be controversy surrounding the choice of President Robert Mugabe as chairman of the AU. How is the reaction there?
The reaction here has been very different from what has been in the media and outside. Most of the diplomats here, most of the delegates who are here, were applauding President Robert Mugabe. They were happy that he is now the current chairperson of the AU. There is opposition within some. I've heard that the South African government was campaigning against him in other regions. That's President Zuma and his people going to regions trying to say they don't think that President Robert Mugabe is the right candidate. But unfortunately, the other regions were for President Robert Mugabe. And South Africa, which will be hosting the next AU summit in June, would have wanted to be both AU chairperson and hosting the summit. At the same time, their bid failed in the region. But mostly from what I have seen and the people that I've spoken with here, despite the controversy of President Robert Mugabe's alleged human rights record and President Robert Mugabe's age, they have been very supportive in saying, you know, he is an elder statesman, that he understands the continent and where it is coming from. But most of them that I have interviewed are saying he speaks the things that, you know, most African leaders would want to say but cannot afford to say. So at the end of the day, because Mr. Mugabe has nothing to lose, he has already been ostracized by the West for his actions, in particular, you know, his alleged human rights records, the taking away of the land from the white commercial farmers, as he says, he thinks he's being punished. So he doesn't seem to be a man with anything to lose. So from what I have seen, truthfully speaking, I was shocked by the amount of support and the ululation that came his way when he got that post.
Now, talking about the summit, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made a bit of a news after saying that African leaders should stop clinging to power. How was his speech received by the leaders?
Yesterday, there was some applause when he said that from some sections within the assembly. But generally, when I was now speaking to diplomats and others, asking them what they thought of that speech, most of them were saying, who is he to lecture us? So today, I had an opportunity to ask Secretary General, you know, what he thinks of those thoughts by some African leaders or some African diplomats that he has nothing to do with their term limits or how they run their countries in Africa. And he said he was saying, he said that statement from conviction of what he has seen in the past 8 years as the Secretary General of the United Nations, that some conflicts in the region, and not only in Africa but elsewhere, have been started simply because some leaders were holding on to power and were changing constitutions because they wanted to remain in office. So he's saying if they stop doing that, then at least we have removed one hurdle that normally creates problems on the African continent in terms of power and, you know, remaining in the office. And he said he didn't, you know, mean to, you know, he wasn't targeting anyone, but he was just saying it because he has seen that in the last 8 years, most conflicts on the African continent have been started as a result of people refusing or leaders refusing to hand over the baton stick but wanting to change the constitution and remain in office.
Sandra, briefly, in 10 seconds, how committed are the leaders to ensuring there's a standby force to combat Boko Haram? Briefly, 10 seconds.
Boko Haram has changed Africa and things are changing. Boko Haram is moving and it looks like they are committed and they've been putting pressure on Nigeria as to why a country with so many resources is failing to contain Boko Haram. I think this time they are serious because the threat is going to go everywhere in Africa.
Thank you very much, Sandra. Sandra Nyaira is a reporter with VOA Zimbabwe Service. She joined us live from Addis Ababa.
Much appreciated, Peter. Good night.
Thank you very much. Still in Ethiopia, the head of the United Nations mission to the Democratic Republic of Congo, or MONUSCO, Martin Kobler, is seeking support from African leaders. Kobler told me earlier that the mandate of the UN mission in DRC still remains the protection of civilians.
Well, we have here the so-called regional oversight mechanism. This is the Addis Ababa Agreement of February 2013, the framework of peace and stability. This is regularly verified with whether the benchmarks are kept, whether the obligations are kept. So this is the reason also I'm here, because this Addis Ababa Agreement, this is one of the means to guarantee the good governance and the security sector reform, and contains all the obligations for the government of the DRC in order also to promote other areas, not only the armed fight. It contains regional commitments. It contains also international commitments to help the DRC in order to get out of this situation they are in now.
You talked about the mandate of MONUSCO, which is paramountly to protect unarmed civilians. How will this bolster or help to protect unarmed civilians in parts of the country where they come under attack, you know, usually from these armed groups?
Yes, we have several armed groups, three big armed groups, where the M23, which that this problem is militarily solved, not politically, but militarily. We have the fightings going on in the north of North Kivu. This is also done together with the FARDC against ADF NALU, an anti-Ugandan Islamist group. So we are fighting at this very moment also with the intervention brigade. The Tanzanian part of the intervention brigade are in the north fighting with them. And we have now the third group. This is the FDLR, this anti-Rwandan genocidal movement, which is dominating large parts of the east of the country.
How has the change of mandate impacted your work in DRC at the moment?
Well, this mandate has been always protection of civilians, right from the beginning. Protection of civilians against armed groups. However, it became more robust in the last 2 years. With the introduction of the intervention brigade, we have now real means to offensively, and the mandate to offensively neutralize armed groups. We introduced for all the groups, we have 20,000 troops in the country, a more robust protection of civilian approach. And not only to wait until something happens, but all, not only the intervention brigade, the whole of MONUSCO forces, they are have to go out, they have to patrol, they have to look for the Mai-Mai groups and for those who terrorize the population. This is a little bit difficult, was a little bit difficult to implement. I'm quite satisfied now with the performance of all troops to go out and to protect actively and robustly civilians.
You've been supporting logistically and other means the FARDC in their fight against these armed groups. The government has instituted the DDR, the demobilization, disarmament and all that. How are you helping in this directive to disarm these armed groups who often attack unarmed civilians in Congo?
Yes, you're trying to important problem. To combat only armed groups or Mai-Mai groups is not good enough. These groups or the combatants of these groups or the ex-combatants have to reintegrate it in society. That's what we call the DDR process. And here we face a serious problem. These are civilian programs to reintegrate them into society, training courses to become farmers or carpenters or whatever. This is quite important, and this does not yet work. The international community is helping the Congolese also here, the so-called National Plan Number 3, outlining these reintegration programs, which has to be financed. We really are in very close contact with the government of the Congo in order to implement these programs.
What assurances will you give residents of the area that MONUSCO protects in DRC?
Well, it's up to the Congolese army to give these assurances. I can give the assurances that we are, together with the FARDC, combating those who terrorize them. And we take our mandate very seriously that we are doing it. We target the combatants. We do not target the civilians. We do not target the Rwandan refugees. We do not target the Congolese Hutus, not the civilian population, not even the dependents of the combatants.
Martin Kobla is the head of the United Nations mission to the DRC or MONUSCO. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Attacks on opposition supporters in Nigeria's Niger Delta are raising fears of greater violence in the region should President Goodluck Jonathan lose his re-election bid February 14. For VOA, Chris Stein reports from the capital, Abuja.
Over the past month, supporters of the opposition All Progressives Congress have been shot at and had their offices bombed in Nigeria's southern Niger Delta region. Voters in this region are expected to overwhelmingly cast ballots for President Goodluck Jonathan, who is from Bayelsa, one of the states that makes up the oil-producing region. The APC is fielding former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari against Mr. Jonathan in what is expected to be Nigeria's most competitive election since the return of democracy in 1999. The presidential poll is on February 14th, followed by state elections on February 28th. Many fear that opposition victories in either vote could spark a backlash of violence against individuals and ethnic groups in the Niger Delta seen as supportive of the APC. Isitoa Azoameni is a political activist and lecturer at the Delta State College of Education in Warri. He blames inflammatory campaign rhetoric for the violence in the region.
People are vying for political office. They should be in a position to sit down and educate the public on the blueprint they have to change their life. In our climes there, that's not what people do. People go on slaw campaign. People go on character assassination. People start digging up things to unnerve them. People want to intimidate others when they have opportunity. And these are the things that result in violence.
Some of the violence in the Delta is seen as retaliatory for events that happen elsewhere in Nigeria. On January 10th, hooligans smashed a campaign bus and other property belonging to the president's People's Democratic Party in the north-central city of Jos. That same day, APC members were attacked in Rivers State during a party meeting. The day after that, an APC office in Rivers State was bombed. Dileon Oyuwe is an assistant to the APC state chairman in Delta State. He says political violence will affect all parties in the country, not just the APC.
The only language they know, you understand, is destruction. And destruction does not single out any political party per se. So in that sense, I say it does not affect only APC. It will equally affect all political parties.
Other issues also heighten the potential for violence. The Delta has long been a hotbed for militancy, with organized bands attacking pipelines and kidnapping foreign oil workers until an amnesty was negotiated in 2009. With most former militants seen as backing the sitting government, Azoameni fears they could take the lead in any post-election violence should Mr. Buhari win. Further complicating matters is the defection of Rivers State Governor Rotimi Amachi to the APC in 2013, which heightened political infighting in that state. Kingsley Kuku is an advisor to Mr. Jonathan on Delta Affairs. He blames the violence on thuggery and infighting within the APC, but added that tension around election time is inevitable.
I don't expect any resurgence of any violence in the Niger Delta now. In any case, in this political era, everybody is busy with the movement towards the election, 14 February and 28 February. Beyond that, certain activities are bound to happen all over the country. The election and the results are bound to make some reactions, to elicit some reactions.
Mr. Buhari, meanwhile, is expected to get most of his political support from Nigeria's north and southwest. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
The Kenyan government says it has been working around the clock to secure the country and fight against terrorism and other threats. For the last year, authorities have been implementing a new community policing initiative called Nyumba Kumi as part of those efforts. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the capital, Nairobi, on how the program is faring and what Kenyans think about its effectiveness.
Traffic moves at a snail's pace in the upscale neighborhood suburb of Runda, and few people can be seen on foot. This is the neighborhood where Kenyan authorities in December arrested 76 Chinese nationals suspected of committing cyber crimes. But Kenyan security agencies only discovered the suspicious activity when one of the houses the Chinese were living caught fire. The incident created a probe as to how the government could have missed such a potentially big criminal threat in the heart of Nairobi. It is one of a long string of incidents where the government has been accused of intelligence failures. Kenyan authorities say they have been working hard to improve security protocols, and one thing is clear, the government can't do it all alone. They say they need the cooperation of every Kenyan citizen in keeping the country safer. And that is where the fairly new community policing initiative comes in. known as Nyumba Kumi, which means 10 households. Nyumba Kumi organizes 10 households in each designated neighborhood to act as a community watch team, which then alerts police and security services to any activities they observe as unusual or suspicious. Kenya adopted the initiative from neighboring Tanzania, where it has reportedly achieved success. But a number of Kenyans are skeptical about its usefulness in their communities. Sammy Mwevu is a creative manager who lives in secured high-end Nairobi neighborhood. He says he doesn't want to know his neighbors and adds that knowing them won't make any difference to his security.
The place I live in, we have a security personnel downstairs. So knowing my neighbor is totally none of my business. Yeah, and doesn't make me feel any secure knowing them, or I don't see it making any change.
Others have concerns that this community watch potentially violates their civil rights. Octavian Gakuru is a professor of sociology at the University of Nairobi.
It's evident that this country has also reached a point of social development and change where individualism is quite pronounced, and privacy is always now one of the highly treasured and social values in this society.
But Professor Gakuru does not write off the program as necessary and effective. He says it depends on where it is implemented.
There are areas where community policing, Nyumba Kumi initiative can work, but there are areas where these initiatives may not quite work easily because of the type of people, social groups and residential arrangements and their living arrangements. The secluded neighborhoods are also such neighborhoods that probably to get the neighbors to talk to each other and work together may be problematic.
The Kenyan government argues community policing can work on a national level to reduce crime and terror attacks by uniting neighbors in their common interest of keeping their communities safe. Residents know their turf better than police and can amplify the reach of law enforcement by acting as extra eyes and ears. Dan Akumu is a security guard and he supports the concept. He thinks it can work even in more secluded and private upscale neighborhoods if people, especially private security, communicate.
So if maybe this is my home, I have my security. Probably the security has been provided through a security firm. And maybe the next neighbor also has got a security. That's a different security firm. The security guards who are here would actually take the responsibility of knowing each other. So I think that's the best way it can work in a rich neighborhood.
But Nairobi resident Sami Mwevu remains unconvinced. He says improving Kenyan security is the government responsibility, especially in light of the last few years of bloody terrorist attack by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab.
I think the first thing the government needs to do is up its game, and especially the intelligence of our country. I think that's the most important thing. Then secondly, secure our borders. First of all, secure your home, then move and spread the peace across the region.
But security agencies say since the launch of the Nyumba Kumi, they have thwarted a number of potential attacks. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, and throughout the month of February, we're collaborating with our partner, Channels TV in Lagos, Nigeria, to bring you a series of programs with complete, in-depth coverage of the upcoming Nigerian presidential election. We'll discuss and dissect all the important issues. That's next time and throughout February on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Sunday Shomari. Next on Let's Talk, beauty, thin versus full figure is the topic we'll discuss in our new lighthearted show, Let's Talk. So join me, Sunday Shomari, and my guest as we explore beauty, thin versus full figure with some hilarity. That's Let's Talk, Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. But first, the African Cup of Nations enters the quarterfinal stage in Equatorial Guinea. My colleague Abdu Shakur Abud of the Kiswahili service of the Voice of America joins us live via telephone link up to give us an update of the tournament. Hello, Shakur.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. What is the atmosphere there at this stage of the competition?
Really, the town of Bata, or the whole country, is a standstill. People are it's the first time since this game started 2 weeks ago that we see there is a festivity sort of climax. Everybody is waiting for the Equatorial Guinea, Tunisia. So there is flags all around. People are in red shirts. There's music everywhere, and people are waiting to see Equatorial Guinea play their first quarterfinals, their second quarterfinals, actually. But it is a very important thing. People are dancing all over the town, and they've said whether they win or lose, they're going to celebrate.
You spoke with the coach of Equatorial Guinea. What did he say about how far his team can go in this competition?
He said morally they are prepared for the semi-finals. He says they want to make history. It's going to be history in this country. It's going to be crazy all around. And he is not afraid. They are not afraid of Tunisia. So they're well prepared for the semi-finals.
Shakur, tell me, what will you say has been the patronage of the games in particular?
Well, the whole thing is that the important thing is that the Equatorial Guinea has been able to organize it very well. What is happening here is that everything is taking place at the moment, at the time which has been set. There's no delay. Everything is well organized when you see that, and then security. So I think what is important is that how the Equatorial Guinea government has handled this whole situation 2 months only before the tournament.
Thank you very much, Shakur, for the latest update. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
I like the way you control it. Mama, they go, they go, eh. Mama, they go, you know, they go, eh. Yes, I like the way you roll. I like the way you roll. You make me lose control. Mama. Yes, you are a winner, sweetheart. You deserve some loving. The way you're moving your body from left and right, you own somebody. Na de pop, look at the men, them look at you. Everybody just feeling you.
Mama, just feeling you.
Really, mama. You go like to the balaga. Chop in the banana. Come on, chop in the banana. I like the way I lose control.
Personally, I rock your body. I promise you go home, you won't tell daddy. I give it to you like you never had it. Screaming, charging, chill, like speaking Chinese. Now waiting me this, pack a boom boom. Now waiting, I see Saga, cause she know one me. She talks, so she know one me.
I know go lie, the things within my mind. When I see you dancing, girl, you got me high. And if you wanna try, make a good day tonight. Cause I'm in the mood, as long as you're feeling the good, I deal with you.
Personally, personally,
I go deal with you.
Personally, personally,
I go deal with you. I go deal with you.
Personally, professionally, I see what you're doing intentionally.
Get me wanted physically.
So give it to me radically. Emotionally, psychologically, you're turning me on biologically. Sexually, dramatically, and she talks that she know one me.
I know go lie, the things within my mind. When I see you dancing, girl, you got me high. And if you wanna try, make a good day tonight. Cause I'm in the mood. As long as you're feeling the good, I go deal with you.
Personally, personally,
I go deal with you.
Personally,
I go deal with you. I go deal with you.
Yeah, exceptionally. Reason is spiritually, money speaking so drastically, magically, internationally, Abba, abatically, grammar, now for dictionary, Saga, cause she know one me, she talks so she know one me.
I know go lie, the things within my mind, when I see you dancing, girl, you got me high, and if you wanna try, make a good day tonight, cause I'm in the mood. As long as you're feeling the good, I go deal with you.
Personally,
I go deal with you.
Personally,
I go deal with you.
You know, say what holiday.
Now the way where you did do the things you do. Oh. It be like say you get plus for me and you. Oh.
If I put it on you, you put it on me. What a man can do, a woman can do. So if you do me, I do you. Man, no go vest up on the dance floor. Man, no go vest, touch me, I touch you. Man, no go vest,
you say.
Man, no go vest,
I say.
Man, no go vest.
If you do me, I do you. Man, no go vest, step on the dance floor. Man, no go
vest. So won't you give it to me?
I go give it to you.
So make you give it to me some more.
Some more.
You get to see the do me, do me. So make you give it to me, give it to me. You get to see the do me, do me. So make you give it to me.
got the way she twist and whine it, whine it. Making me feel like I'm grinding, grinding. Baby girl, I know so you the I mean. After the show, not the party for my room, room. Strictly for me and you, you. We got plenty things to do, do. So pull off your bump and move, make we groove. Hey.
Boy, you know, say talk is cheap. I know you were tempted to roll with me. Me, I know be the busy body where you sing. What a man can do, a woman can do so.
If you do me, I do you. Man, no go vest up on the dance floor. Man, no go vest, touch me, I touch you. Man, no go vest, you say. Man, no go vest, I say. Man, no go vest.
If you do me, I do you.
Man, no go vest,
step on the dance floor.
Man, no go vest. So won't you give it to me?
I go give it to you.
So make you give it to me some more.
Some more.
They get to see that do me. So make you give it to me. Give it to me. They get to see that do me. So make you give it to me some more. Oh. I say, they get to see that do me. So make you give it to me. Man no go vest up on the dance floor. Man no go vest, touch me, I touch you. Man no go vest,
no,
you say. Man no go vest,
no.
I say. Man no go vest.
If you do me, I do you. Man no go vest,
step on the dance floor. Man no go vest, you give it to me.
I go give it to you.
So make you give it to me some more.
Some more.
You get to see that do me. So make you give it to me. Give it to me. You get to see that do me. Do me. So make you give it to me some more.
Chop money.
Hey, it's good to be saving for any days.
Not so.
Cause you know it's here. Life is so delicate. Oh, oh. So make una see me as evidence. Papa got my confidence.
Yes.
His blessings are endless. So
hey.
As if he said I don't go. Some people they bubble.
Hey.
I continue the struggle.
Oh.
The struggle they double my hustle.
Hey.
As if he said I don't go. Some people they bubble.
Hey.
I continue the struggle.
Oh.
They double my hustle. Hey. Now I'm giving my testimony.
Oh.
I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat. Oh.
Hey.
Now I'm giving them everything.
Oh.
testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony. Hey. I don't testimony. Hey. Yeah, my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony. Hey. I don't testimony. Hey. Hey. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Hey. Okay. Je m'appelle Chop Money.
I see be saying I don't go. Some people they bop low. I continue the struggle. The struggle they double my hustle. I see be saying I don't go. Some people they bop low. I continue the struggle. They double my hustle. Now I'm giving my testimony. I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat.
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a good opportunity for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. Every passing week, I pay close attention to the news reports and see what the Africans' opinion is and attitude towards America. This week, the headlines worldwide cover the visit of the President of the United States to Asia, particularly to India. And of course, unfortunately, with the demise of the Saudi king, the president paid official visit to Saudi Arabia. All these developments have implications for U.S. policy towards Africa because they are part of world events with consequences for the United States and the visited countries, and they have consequences for American policy towards Africa because most of these diplomatic issues are related. They go back to the core, and Africa's relations with India is very much linked to Africa's relations with the United States. Let us connect the dots and see how President Obama's visit to India and to Saudi Arabia affect Africa's opinions on and attitude towards the United States. When President Obama visited India, it was the result of changing times in India's relations with the United States. During the Cold War, India was clearly different from Pakistan because the Indian leadership under Jawaharlal Nehru tried to keep themselves away from the big powers, being very close to China, and China was very close to the Soviet Union. India was very mindful of Soviet policy towards the region and Chinese policy towards India. When the collapse between the Soviet Union and China took place, India, in a way, benefited from that relationship. The Pakistanis, who were rivals to India, benefited from these new relationships. And of course, if you look at U.S. policy towards China and the Soviet Union, U.S. policy towards India, you go back to the Jawaharlal Nehru days. The opposition party to the dominant party in India in recent times turned out to be BJP. And the BJP is the mother of the current president of India. And this has implications for U.S. policy. And, of course, it has consequences for U.S. policy towards Pakistan, U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia, and, of course, has implications for African countries. During the Cold War, Kwame Nkrumah, who went to Bandung, was the link between India and Africa. And that affected American policy. During the Eisenhower and Kennedy administration, India, China, Soviet Union, and Africa were all connected because of the Cold War. All over the world, the people were divided between the pro-Western and the anti-Western. With the collapse of the Soviet Union in 89, the dice was rolled again. The world used to change. And this is the background you have to pay close attention to understand President Obama's visit to India. Because the Indian government has decided to really develop new relationships. The implication for Africa is very clear in terms of this new diplomacy. India, China, and Russia are all part of BRICS. And South Africa is the only African country in that connection. It's very different from Bandung. It's very different from the Cold War. So when President Obama went to India, you have a new day in American-Indian relations. It has implications for Africa. Africa's policy towards India is very long. The Indian foreign policy was very much involved with the British. And that's why you have like number of Indians in Africa and in South Africa and other parts of the region. You talk about President Obama's visit to India, you have to do it in light of this background. And so many Indian scholars, many writers, movie makers, they'll be very much involved in this new narrative and what is going to happen on the BRICS. So African policy towards African-American United States is very much going to be affected by these new developments. And American policymakers are paying close attention to these new developments. We are now going through the post-Cold War period. We are now looking at BRICS and the United States, BRICS and Africa. So when you talk about African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States, you have to underscore three problems. Recently, President Obama's great serious involvement with the Ebola demonstrates clearly that the United States has been able to do for the Africans something that has not been highly profiled as a Russian intervention in the solving of a problem in Africa. Chinese involvement in the solving of disease in Africa, or the whole BRICS nation and Ebola. This is one interesting problem that has serious consequences for American policymakers and the African people. Second issue that is very critical. The president of the United States invited all the African leaders here. When he went to India, that was something of consequences for the Indian leadership and for the African leadership. The Indian government is now a rising power in world history, just like the Chinese, they're all part of BRICS. The Russians are part of a big camp, former superpower that used to have influence over all these countries, so the world has changed. This third issue is very critical. It has consequences for human beings. So when President Obama went to India, it is a new beginning in world history. The Indian leadership, Chinese leadership, Soviet leadership, Brazilian leadership, and BRICS leadership have a new relationship in America, and they have consequences for Africa. The African leaders who came for the summit, whether they thought about it or not, must pay attention to these new realities. We need to have new diplomacy, and the African leadership have to come back to Washington next year for an order serious dialogue with the United States. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. We'll be right back. Guideline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, a successful person is one who can lay a firm foundation with the bricks that others throw at him or her. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of Zambia have elected a new president, choosing Defense and Justice Minister Edgar Lunga to finish the term of former President Michael Sata, who died in office last fall. In closely contested balloting January 20th, hampered by heavy rains across much of the southern African nation, Lunga edged businessman Hakainde Hichilema with 48.3% of the vote. The United States congratulates the people of the Republic of Zambia for conducting another democratic election. Facing significant logistical challenges, Zambians went to the polls to uphold their democratic traditions and set an example for African nations and for the world. We acknowledge the important work of the Electoral Commission of Zambia and its chair, as well as the domestic, regional, and international monitoring groups. We hope that any issues will be resolved in the same spirit and democratic tradition. We encourage the people of Zambia to move forward, as their national motto states, as one Zambia, one nation. We look forward to continuing to strengthen our relationship with the government of the Republic of Zambia and its newly elected president, Edgar Lungu. Together, our two nations have a strong friendship on which to build. The United States and Zambia cooperate on providing health care to those most in need, promoting peace and security in the region, attracting investment, and on spurring economic development. We look forward to building an even more dynamic and positive partnership in the years to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.